Get in, losers. We're going podcasting. Folks, it's an absolute pleasure and a delight and so exciting to let you know that this year you have to remember the 5th of November, not just because of a Catholic plot to blow up the Houses of Parliament in 1605, but also because, worst foot forward, we have a bloody live show again. That's right. It's all happening here on the 5th of November as part of the Cheerful Earful Podcast Festival. Ben and I are going to be hosting a live recording of Worst Foot Forward on the 5th of November at midday, high noon, in the Bedford Pub, which is 77 Bedford Hill, London, SW12 9HD, for those of you who love postcodes. And as I said, it's all part of the Cheerful Earful Podcast Festival, which is a brilliant festival of comedy podcasts, very accessible to performers, and highly recommend you go to some of their show. I mean, God, they've got a bloody great lineup. They've got the likes of Pappy's Flatshare, the Socially Distanced Sports Bar, Desert Island Dicks, My Mate Bought a Toaster, and some friends of the show have their podcasts going there as well. Callie Beaton's Namaste Motherfuckers, the whole gang from Mystery on the Rocks, Chris, Suze and Masood. A gay and a non-gay, that's James Barr and Dan Hudson, the Lore Men, and like I said, ourselves, and we have a brilliant pair of guests, let me tell you. We are going to be hosting an episode about the world's worst siblings with actual real-life siblings. Laura Lex returns to the podcast, so good we decided to get her back a mere 5 years after she first appeared. She's going to be coming on the show along with her brother Ron, who she co-hosts the podcast Lex Education with. In Lex Education, Laura tries to relearn all of her GCSE science in the company of her younger brother, non-Canadian, clever person, Ron. And, well, we're going to see just how quickly we can destroy their relationship forever by having them discuss the topic of worst siblings when they come on the live show. That's the 5th of November, as I said, as part of the Cheerful Earful Podcast Festival. So to get tickets, head to cheerfulearful.co.uk. Head to the lineup page and you can see the Worst Foot Forward feet proudly on display and click the tickets link. I've also put the link to the ticket vendor via Design My Night in the description of this podcast as well. So hopefully see a bunch of you there. We are so excited to be doing another live show. Our last one was, God, when was it? Vault Festival back in the early part of the year, back in February. So it's about time we dusted down the old microphones, put on our best faces for radio and hightailed it to the Bedford Pub. Let us know if you're coming. Drop us a line via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, email, all the usual places. It would be lovely to have a bunch of friendly faces, like I said, for a midday recording. And then you can all treat yourselves to a slap-up roast dinner. A Sunday roast. What better way to wash down all the podcasting? So hopefully see a bunch of you for our live show with Laura Lex and her brother Ron, all about the world's worst siblings, November the 5th at midday. Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. To quote Sammy Davis Jr., who can take the sunrise, sprinkle it with dew, cover it with chocolate and a miracle or two? The Candyman can. The Candyman can, because he, and at which point, he having said it five times, the Candyman appeared and killed Sammy Davis Jr. Little known fact about Sammy, wasn't cancer. It was the Candyman. And alongside me is the sweets to my sweet, the lolly to my pop, and the M to my M. It's Ben Vandeveld.
Oh, hello. I thought you were going to quote a different thing. The sweets to my sweet, the sugar to my honey.
Yeah.
I can't remember which bit of bad 90s cod reggae that is from, but I don't know if it it might be Chakademus with or without pliers or someone like that.
We've already activated Ben's Wikipedia mode.
my broken Wikipedia mode.
Yeah. We both have pretty sweet teeth, don't we?
I do have pretty sweet teeth. I mean, if I had to live with only sweet or savoury, it would be savoury, because a life without Marmite is not a life worth living.
Have you ever dipped like something sweet in your Marmite?
My wife. No. I mean, literally for the first time the other night, I had garlic bread, cheesy garlic bread with Marmite dripped on it, which is not sweet. that was a bit of a game changer. I can't think of anything sweet. So the heresy that my wife, with her Italian background, will not approve of, apparently you can add Marmite to bolognese to give it a bit of a kick. But I imagine if you did a sort of like salted caramel Marmite thing.
I do. I put sugar in my bolognese sauce. Just a little bit of it.
You are never welcome in our house again.
I know. Your Italian wife will disown me. I think we've talked about in the show before when we played board games, your ideal snack is jelly babies, because if things are going bad, you can bite the heads off them in rage.
Oh, God, yeah. There's nothing better than doing some brutal torture on a bit of confectionery.
Yeah. I have a particular love for marshmallows, as I think we've discussed on the podcast before. But I also, if I'm particularly decadent mood, I like getting those Cadbury's caramel nibbles, which are basically chocolate buttons with caramels in them, and making a little marshmallow sandwich with them.
Oh.
To really accelerate my heart attack.
I'm mostly of the opinion that it's not really a sweet, and it's not really a pudding unless chocolate is involved. Right. I feel like such a grown up if I go out to a restaurant and I order a dessert with any fruit in it.
Right, so like a baked pear or something like that, or poached plums.
Oh my God, I feel like an 18th century duchess if I order one of those. Whereas most of the time, I'm a 6-year-old American schoolboy. Those are my two aliases when I am on the internet. And both of them I clean up in online poker games.
Yeah, the Duchess and at Chad 2007.
Before I blow any more of my covers, we should introduce this week's guest. Our guest this week is an actor, screenwriter, horror buff, and pop history nerd. He has appeared in the Olivier-nominated production of The Sound of Music at the Regent's Park Open Air Theatre and the world premiere production of Tiger Bay at the Wales Millennium Centre. Now, I don't know The Sound of Music, haven't watched it, because if there's going to be a musical involving Nazis on my TV, it's going to be The Producers. So when I read our guest's CV and that he played the role of Rolf Gruber, I have to say that I was delighted and amazed and honoured to introduce a man that could play the part of a felt piano playing dog with a penchant for East German terrorism and bank heists. So please welcome an exceptional thief who is moving up to podcasting, but don't worry, he will be polite. It's Joshua Tonks.
What a fantastic intro. Thank you, Ben. Cheers.
You're
hi.
You're welcome. Hello.
I thought you were going to say it's great to have someone on the show. Finally, we've got a Nazi in real life.
Do you know what? We're going to have to do that. Yeah.
Yes.
The logical endpoint of this podcast is that we get a Nazi on air and together the three of us kill a dog.
These are tropes that frequently pop up on the show. It's so lovely having you'll get used to it. It's lovely having Josh on, because I first saw Josh in a pantomime about 12 years ago in the Lyric Hammersmith.
You did, didn't you?
Yeah, being very funny.
Once upon a time. Hopefully that has continued to now.
I enjoyed the performance so much it took 12 years to get you on my podcast.
Which, to be fair, you know, the podcast has only existed for 6 years, so that would be... You were just like, 6 years in, go like, do you know what? I'm going to have to create a podcast to get this man on my show.
Yeah.
Well, I feel very honoured regardless, even though the maths and the timing doesn't quite add up.
Yeah, well, the timing, it does line up in one way, because as Ben mentioned, you are a horror buff and have appeared on many a horror podcast. And you're
effortless segue as I interrupt you, but flawless!
Right! And you're currently starring in a horror movie, a slasher movie of your own.
Do you want to tell
people about that?
Yeah, so I've got a film out at the moment. It's called The Latent Image. It's like a queer mystery thriller about a writer in a cabin in the woods who encounters a stranger one night that may or may not be a criminal and may or may not be a work of fiction. It's like a low budget, intimate thriller. It takes place pretty much in one location, and you can rent it on Prime at the moment. We've even got a DVD coming out like it's 2007, so you can pre-order that.
A vinyl DVD.
Here's a question that just occurred to me. Like, a classic sort of 80s horror trope is that the order of death in a horror movie would be black person, virgin, queer person. Has anyone sort of reversed that where it's like white heteronormative people who get bumped off?
Well, I kind of feel that that's now going to be every horror movie because they're trying to shift the rules. But actually, if this were QI, this is where I'd be hitting that big noise to tell you that you're a bit wrong. Yes, traditionally the black person does die first, but it's not always the case. There's actually a really great documentary called Horror Noir, which you can watch on Shudder, which goes through the history of black horror. You've got, you know, collaborators like Jordan Peele that speak about it. But they don't die first, and it just depends which era we're in. Absolutely. And as for gay characters, they tended just to be omitted completely. unless they're like a British villain. You know what I mean?
I like that you describe the person who shows up at the cabin in your film as, is he a criminal? Is he a work of fiction? It sounds like the film has like taken the movie Stranger Than Fiction and Whistle Down the Wind and smashed them together with a horror coat on.
With a little bit of misery peppered in.
Yeah.
Well, and for the academics in the room, a little bit of Pirandello Six Characters in Search of a Horror Movie.
There are no academics in the room.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, you get sexy in the film.
I do get a bit sexy, yeah.
Absolutely. It's, you know, for people who are looking for a sexy horror film.
Yeah, we were definitely inspired by the 90s erotic thriller.
Yeah. I just have to mention the word Scream and it'll set you off.
Oh, yeah, but... yeah. I mean, are you ready for my TED talk on Scream?
Yeah. Before we lead you down a dangerous path
route, where,
Joss is very clearly a fountain of knowledge when it comes to all things horror, but what are you less good at? What are you worst at in the world?
So when you asked this question, it did take a minute, but I got there.
Because you're just so good.
a metaphorical minute, which was a while. Face painting. Children's face painting. So I actually, when I'm not acting, work with kids a lot. I teach theatre, and I've run the gamut of children's parties, after school clubs, Saturday morning schools, all of this. There was one occasion where I was required to face paint, and I face painted one child, who then proceeded to look in the mirror, and she was very nice about it, but just so quietly go over to the other person that was painting faces and ask them to wash it off and start again.
Oh no.
Because it didn't look like a bunny rabbit or a butterfly or a, I don't know. But yeah, face painting, dreadful. Oh. I'm quite artistic, but
yeah,
painting on faces.
What about your own face?
No.
No?
Bad.
Even harder, yeah.
Bad, yeah.
It's very difficult. I bought for my son's pirate birthday party some face paint just so I could put on scars and beards, and it is quite a fun thing to be putting stubble on a blonde 4-year-old girl, but anything more sophisticated, the face is not a natural canvas.
No. That's why Da Vinci never worked on faces.
Yeah.
Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel ceiling, he was going to get them to plaster it with lots of faces, but actually they thought actually just bricks and mortar would make more sense.
Oh, I thought you said he was going to just paint it on the Pope's face. Just hang the Pope sort of like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, so dangling above Michelangelo.
And Michelangelo lying on his back below it.
Yes, absolutely.
Face to face. Yeah.
Yeah, and just going, oh, no, Your Eminence. This is just how I like to do it. There's nothing else behind this at all.
I think the problem with face painting for kids' parties especially is that it's a bit like when you go into a barbershop and they have the photographs of haircuts.
Oh, yeah.
Because often you have these photographs of like people perfectly face painted in like a little like album that you go, do you want the snow leopard or the bunny rabbit or the giraffe, and they go, I want that one, and then there's no way in the world you, an out of work actor who does this every second weekend,
and God forbid you know they want to be a tiger, it's like, I can't find an orange, there's an orange in here, what are we doing? And the only difference I think actually though between face painting and getting your hair cut where they have those is that the face paintings look like they're timeless, those images.
Yes.
Whereas all the images in a hair salon, well, they all seem to, you know, be from like 1994.
Yes.
Well, the face paintings seem timeless because they paint the children's faces and then they lacquer the children.
Yeah.
Ah, yeah. It's like House of Wax.
Yes.
This week, with Halloween approaching, we thought it was time to go trick-or-treating with our topic. We are talking about the world's worst candy. A contentious term, even in itself. Is it sweets? Is it candy? Ben is already making faces at me. Ben, why don't you start us off?
I absolutely refute the notion of candy. Candy is only permissible if it is followed by floss. Or perhaps prefixed with baby wants. But I can't be doing it. It's too Americanized. Sweets is fine. I quite like confectionery because I am actually from the 1880s at heart. The first thing I looked at from my wife's beloved homeland was the deep fried Mars bar.
Have you had one?
I haven't just had one. At my a friend's wedding, their dessert was deep fried Mars bar. And I ate one and went, that's delicious. And someone else at the table didn't want one. And I was like, well, I think I'll have two. I'd immediately regretted it. Honestly, it was the confectionery equivalent of going, another yard of ale, barkeep.
You know the way I say that it wasn't moorish, it was lessish.
Oh, God. I mean, it was like the first one was incredible. And I felt like I was ready to wrestle a Highland cow, but wow. The second one was an error.
Specifically a Highland cow.
Oh, yes, specifically. They're actually quite good to wrestle because they've got long hair, so there's a lot to grab onto.
Ah, yeah. Okay, cool. The more you know.
But on this downside, it does feel like bullying because they're ginger.
Was it full size, like a regular Mars bar?
No,
was it like
it
mini
a
bar,
fun
mini,
size
mini Mars
bar.
I don't know. You know, like maybe it was like a fancy Michelin star deep fried Mars bar. The portions are always smaller.
Yeah, no. It was a proper hefty Mars bar with that weird vein across it as well. I don't know why.
Weird vein.
You know what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah, the aggressive vein. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, and it's also like chocolate, bit gay, let's give it a big masculine vein, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are we fans of Mars bars, by the way, just in general?
I love a Mars bar.
I quite like one. The problem with them is they're like, the first bite is delicious, but also the first bite reminds you that you can't eat a whole Mars bar and feel terrific afterwards.
Mm. The trick to Mars bars, this is something that my dad used to do that I've not seen for ages. My dad would put his Mars bar in the fridge and then have thin slices of it.
Oh yeah.
That's very decadent.
Like slicing a Serrano ham.
Yeah, no, that's how he had it. He actually sort of had it in one of those clamps and would slowly like shave off bits of Mars bar. I like deep fried Mars bars. They were invented somewhere between the 80s and the 90s, and there's sort of like so many of these things a debate in the chip shop community as where who made the first ever deep fried Mars bar.
Were they invented by accident, like so many great inventions? And someone like knock a Mars bar into the fryer and go, hang on.
They
second.
Were like, no. And then they ate it. They were like, yes.
Yeah, gosh, I don't know. They were so prevalent, The Lancet commissioned a report by the University of Dundee to validate the association between Scotland and the deep-fried Mars bar. So I love that the medical authorities are getting involved. Mm. And when it took place, a survey of 627 fish and chip shops, three-quarters of the respondents said they had been selling them, but only in the past 3 years. And that was, I think, done in the early 21st century. So they're not a particularly old invention at all. Mm. Three-quarters of them, those that were sold to children, so not to, you know, alkies on the way home.
Excellent. And they sold, doing lots for Scotland's notoriously low life expectancy.
Yeah, and they sold between 50 and 200 a week. But the biggest deep-fried abomination, because people have experimented with deep-frying different confectionery, in her 1999 book, Nigella Bites, Nigella Lawson deep-fried a bounty bar.
Interesting.
The worst, objectively the worst chocolate bar.
Bounties aren't my favourite. There'll always be someone in the friendship group that you can pawn them off to, you know what I mean?
At Christmas, there's one person with a pile of bounty wrappers in front of them because everyone else has decamped it.
And honestly, they're a Christmas miracle. God bless them, you know?
Yeah. Next, I found this thing. I think it's sort of a bit of sort of internet archaeology, but I found a thing called the King's Hand, which was invented by a 28-year-old data analyst who said the idea for the dish came to her in a dream in which it was the main course of a festival feast. And the king's hand is made of cookie dough fortified with M&Ms and moulded into the shape of a hollow hand. So far, so knockoff Ben and Jerry's. But yeah. Then it is baked and filled with Greek salad.
Ruined it.
Why?
I knew they were going to fill it with something, and yeah. I knew it wasn't going to be nice.
Yeah, it was a dream, lads.
When you say fill it, they like put it inside it, or they have the hand like holding it.
No, they filled it. They stuffed it.
Can't even scrape it off then.
Yeah, horrible, right?
What was the king been doing to have all that stuff on his hand?
Well, I think the king is sort of going like saying to the queen, "Yes, darling, I am eating healthily, but hiding it inside what he prefers." Going back to my least favourite nomenclature for this sort of food, do you know what the link between the American Senate and candy is?
Diabetes.
Yeah. Well, quite.
It's a lot of old people with diabetes. A lot of diabetes and candy. Was the term candy coined by an American senator whose surname was Candy, like John Candy, the actor?
No, it was not. It's that if you serve in the United States Senate since 1965, you've been able to have access to the Senate candy drawer in the Senate candy desk.
And sorry, there's a Senate candy desk.
Yes, and infuriatingly, it's on the Republican side.
Oh, so it's one of the benches at which senators seat is designated the candy desk.
Yes. So in 1965, Senator George Murphy, who had a legendary sweet tooth, began stocking his desk drawer full of sweets and offered them to other senators who were passing by. And when he lost his seat in 1970, the next senator continued the tradition.
Oh,
and it continues to this day. There's like famous little clips of when Trump had to give evidence before the Senate for one of the many things he did wrong. There were people walking away from the candy desk, brandishing candies that they'd taken as they listened to him going, oh yeah, that sounds terrible that you're trying to undermine democracy. Oh, what delicious lollipops.
Wow. Do you know who the current occupant of the desk is?
I'm going to tell you that in a minute, but I want to tell you about previous occupants of the desk.
Ooh. Oh, right.
Because they include such good-hearted Willy Wonka-esque luminaries as John McCain, not a terrible guy, but not a great guy, and Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I know. No. The worst one.
The worst one.
There was a bit of not controversy, but issue when Senator Craig Thomas took over in 2007. He was from Wyoming, and Wyoming didn't have any well-known candy companies, and people were like, "Oh, the standard of candy in Congress is going to drop."
of course, because they can only buy it from their home states because politicians are fucking idiots.
Yes, who's there now then, Barry?
It's Senator Todd Young of Indiana. I mean, this candy desk is huge news, and the fact that the American president has the Resolute desk must be such a disappointment to them that the only thing they find in them are like pens and occasionally White House interns, as opposed to candy.
Yes.
What would you keep in your desk?
I mean, I'm not gonna lie. I have a little side table over in the corner of my flat, which is within my eyeline right now. Which contains regularly bags of sweets and bars of chocolate.
I'm genuinely astonished that you and your husband don't have rotting teeth and massive sugar guts.
You gotta brush good, because all those galaxy bars don't clean themselves off.
Yeah, you do, but like, honestly, the pair of you have metabolisms to die for. It's infuriating. Little bit of history before we go to my selection. First of all, we are going to go to Bradford in the year 1858. And I'm going to tell you about a gentleman called William Hardacre, who set up a sweet stall in Greenmarket, a place where factory workers would line up and spend their wages on humbugs to sort of take home to their kids. What do you think was wrong with the humbugs that he made that day?
Ooh. So humbugs are like little boiled, minty
little boiled
sort of sweets,
black and white peppermint sweets. Yeah,
yeah. Was it as is so often the case in Victorian era, mercury or lead poisoning?
You are not far off. They were chock full of arsenic.
Oh, there we are.
Yeah. So, that, like, by the next day, having sold £5 of sweets, two local children were dead.
Oh, wow.
And then the sweet death spree continued. it wasn't just kids, like adults who had tried the sweets, like to find out what was going on. They fell ill. So the first person who was accused of this was a chap called Joseph Neal, who was like the wholesaler who sold the humbugs to Hardacre. But it turns out it went even further back, because the chap who worked for Neil to go and buy the ingredients for it had gone to the place they bought all the ingredients from and found that the guy who ran it, Charles Hodgson, was ill, and there was like the work experience boy at the front, a chap called William Goddard.
And a Victorian work experience boy who was probably about four.
Yeah, exactly. And so the sweets were made of sugar, gum, water, peppermint, oil, and something called daft. And daft was sort of like a filler to replace sugar. Your man said, "Where can I find the daft for the sweets?" And he went, "Oh, that big barrel that is unmarked and full of white powder. Go over there."
No.
And instead of getting out the daft, he had pulled out 12 pounds of arsenic trioxide.
Oh, no.
And so each sweet contained enough poison to kill a grown man.
Holy shit.
So you might say that William was being a little daft.
Don't. Joshua, don't.
It had to happen.
It had to happen.
The upshot of this, and this is one of those classic, why was this not statute law already? But it led to the passing of the Pharmacy Act of 1868.
Which banned poison in sweets, you're going to tell me?
No, but basically the poisons could only be sold in specific bottles made from coloured textured glass to provide a strong visual cue of their contents. And specific poisons also had to be labelled. They had to be labelled rather than going, do you want to go to my lethal pick and mix shelf?
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah.
Yes, please.
Live a little.
And then the final thing I want to tell you before my choice, what is unusual about many sweets that were served to people in Sweden in the late 19th century?
They weren't sweet at all. They were savoury. They were nuts.
Nope. Where would you more likely, or to what occasion would you be given sweets?
Christmas.
Mm-mm.
Birthdays.
Nope.
Funerals.
There you go.
Ah.
Wow.
Yeah. That people would give small sugar sculptured things like doves that were covered in black lace and fabric flowers, and they were mementos on the occasion of people dying. And it was a huge part of the way that occasion was carried out. They would be for other occasions as well, weddings and baptisms and anniversaries. But also,
you're going to say everyone got funeral wreaths on their birthdays.
Yeah. lovely, my bar mitzvah skull. Yeah. But the sweets would have wrappers that were carrying lithographs of skulls and graves and skeletons. Oh.
Gothy as fuck. I love it.
Yeah, right. Others would have things like a skeletal figure snipping the strings of time, or scythes and hourglasses. Even, you know, at funerals of very young children, because, of course, infant mortality very high in these times. Mm-hmm. So there is one inscription on a candy wrapper for one Ernst Axel Jacob von Post, baptized in distress and died the day after his birth. And that is decorated with a glossy black label with a tombstone and a skull and crossbones.
Wow. That was silver lining to any funeral. Get some sweeties.
Yeah. Well, no, but they weren't very nice. So they were a mixture of sugar.
Of course.
And something called tragacanth, which was like basically glue.
Swedish for arsenic.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a self-perpetuating circle of funeral sweets.
The whole idea was coined by funeral directors, oddly enough.
And it was a global conspiracy, right?
Yeah.
Yes, what, by Big Graveyard?
You're in the pocket of Big Graveyard.
Yes. So, yeah, we're in the tomb of Big Graveyard. So they delighted me. But the thing I want to talk about is military chocolate. Because this sounds disgusting. It has been part of standard American military rations since 1937, and it was made by the Hershey Company. And it was formulated with four main requirements by a chap called Colonel Logan, who was put in charge of liaising with Hershey's. And he said, one, it's got to weigh 4 ounces. Fine. Two, it's got to be high in food energy value. Great. Three, it's got to be able to withstand high temperatures because, you know, they're in the theatre of battle. It's often in hot places. But four, it must taste little better than a boiled potato to make sure that soldiers don't eat their emergency rations in non-emergency situations.
Right.
Do you know what I like in my chocolate? That it's heat resistant. Just imagine how delicious those chemicals will be, gentlemen.
The first thing I was thinking, for sure. Yeah. What? Yeah. Just give me a boiled potato or whatever. Like, I don't need it then. What's the point?
It doesn't melt in your mouth.
Yeah.
Or taste
nice.
Yeah.
But wait, it got even more properties as warfare continued in the 20th century. So after tests in the Philippines and Panama on the Texas border, it bizarrely made its way to the Antarctic during an expedition there. But after the attack on Pearl Harbor, there were further requirements of the D-ration chocolate. It, as well as being high temperature proof, it must also be poison gas proof. So just imagine what that did to the flavor.
So it's not porous either.
Nope.
Presumably.
It was made in enormous quantities because when America joined the war, Congress wanted to ration sugar, corn syrup and cocoa, and Milton Hershey had to lobby Congress to go, no, this is really important for my company and also the military. Between 1940 and 45, he made 3 billion units of this to send around the world. But it was so disgusting, troops nicknamed it Hitler's secret weapon because it was so harmful to their intestinal tracts.
Oh, no.
It couldn't be eaten if you didn't have like good enough teeth. And we talked about this earlier with my dad. The only real way of eating it was to shave slices off your bar with a knife.
Oh, you had to whittle your chocolate.
You had to. It's not a happy euphemism.
Yeah. No.
And a further version of it, known as the Tropical Bar, was created post-1945 and was used in the theatre sort of the Korean War when they were facing off against Chinese troops and then also made its way into the Vietnam War. And it was nicknamed the dysentery ration, as it was the bar was the only ration that people with dysentery could tolerate. So it is, I know, real, real grim. And still, somehow, it has managed to make its way into space. The D-ration bar was aboard Apollo 15 in 1971.
Wow.
Made its way all the way into zero gravity.
And can survive up in space as well.
Oh, yeah. It is tardigrade's favourite candy.
Yeah.
I mean, what a treat. Well, you know, that's what I want to put in my body. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Inedible, unmeltable... Essentially indestructible. Like a bullet.
Essentially
a bullet in candy form.
You would like to hope that, you know, there's that famous Bible that stopped a bullet. There must have been hundreds of these bars of chocolate that stopped bullets.
And yet still more appealing to me than the hand filled with the cream or whatever. You know what I mean? Still more appealing. Mine's more divisive, I guess. Some people like it. We could even argue that it's maybe the Marmite of candy, and that would be
what in that it's great.
I like Marmite for sure, but I don't like these Parma violets.
Ooh, yeah. Mm. Now I have never had one because I'm endlessly suspicious of them,
and rightly so, I feel.
Yeah.
So they were invented by Swizzles. Which is a company that sort of started in 1928 by Alfred and Maurice Malto. They then teamed up with this guy called David D in 1933, and that's when they got the name. But they were making candy before. Their initial concept was to make fizzy sweets in a compressed tablet form, but then eventually, because they're still around now, they just have hit us with so many bangers, which is why, for me, Parma Violets are so disappointing. So we've got Love Hearts. We've got drumsticks.
Yes.
We've got refreshers.
Absolutely, yes.
Banger, banger, banger. Love, some of my faves. And yet we have Parma Violets. Now, they almost taste like perfumed. And so when they were first made, which was, if I'm checking my notes, 1946. So they're super old.
Right. Just after the war, this is what people want.
Yeah, and they were sold in pubs as perfume sweets, but they were marketed as like breath fresheners, which tells me all I need to know. You know what I mean?
Yeah, everyone is smoking at the time, so I guess.
Yeah, but that's not the kind of thing that I want in my party packet. And I think for me, Parma Violets, I just associate with being a kid at a birthday party and looking in like the little treat bag that you might get and seeing Parma Violets in there and just being like, great. Why?
Why are they called Parma Violets? Is there... Because Parma's in Italy, right? Oh, there's a plant called a Parma Violet. I just had a look.
Oh, that's that.
Italian.
Yeah,
an probably Italian plant, that. So it's named after that. I thought it was going to have some cool like backstory where it was invented in Italy and it's a traditional family recipe, but it's no.
And it's filled
it's
with
just
ham.
After the war. It's filled with, yeah.
The flavor is perfume, lavender, and violets. Like,
yeah.
Not for me. I'm not what do we, how do we feel generally about like floral flavors?
I'm not, because people love putting like
rose
like
in things.
Rose in things, particularly in like baking stuff.
Yeah.
And it's either non-existent or the only thing you can taste.
Yeah.
And they're not pleasant smells. It's like, oh, I'm swallowing some potpourri now.
Yeah, no, it's not the best. It's not the best. So yeah, I mean, you guys went to birthday parties as kids, yeah. Right? You know, did you get little party bags and stuff like that?
Yeah, Parma Violets aren't really a thing in Ireland.
Are they
the
not?
Other sweets you mentioned, yeah, the other sweets you mentioned have all made it across the Irish Sea, but yeah. The Parma Violet has resolutely stayed this side. I think even our listeners abroad,
well, maybe
in the UK won't know.
You just
either,
have so good taste.
Yeah,
good taste. I just want to give them away. They're like a bounty almost. They're kind of the equivalent of that, but like in candy form.
Yeah, but because they've got that floral taste, and also they're like like you said, a fizzy sweet. There's something a bit mm-hmm. medicinal about them, like they should be like a Pepto-Bismol type.
Oh yeah, thing. Absolutely. You can imagine that back in the day, maybe people like, in the same way that people think like, oh yeah, have some Lucozade after you've been sick, and it's like,
yeah.
They have to actually say on the bottle now, like, don't, that's, this is an old wives' tale. What are you doing?
Do you know why Snickers were called Marathon in the UK?
Was it supposed to give you energy for running?
It was meant to be a health... They were trying to market it as a health bar.
Just a tangled web of lies, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. So I could imagine that Parma Violets, like, oh, yeah, they've got medicinal properties. Probably not, but you know what people do.
Yeah. Also, the colour of the colour of them, I think because there's not really any other sweets that are that colour.
Mm, very pretty. I had to look on the website and I was like, this kind of, like, lilac-y lavender vibe is, like... I'm like, I would get the merch. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'd get everything but the sweet. Like, I'd get a Parma Violet pillow. Fine. Fabulous.
Yeah.
Apparently, they're making Parma Violet cheese. I had a look.
That is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
What? The same company?
Yeah.
That seems wild to me. There is a Parma Violet gin available. Again, not the same company. But, I think the thing is as well, because obviously that flower has probably existed for or been known about mm-hmm. for much, much longer. But now... The only thing people, when they hear Parma Violet, is they'll think of is the sweet. I think, I don't know if it's a boon or not to market your Parma Violet gin with the name of the worst party bag sweet.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way they've sold it now is the fact that it's polarizing. And I think that that's
leaning
part
into
of
that.
Yeah, they know for sure. They've even got a thing on the website where you can... oh God, I'm looking into the cheese. We'll get there in a sec. Where they kind of give sort of like fun, cute examples of things that like are a yes that you would like to see Parma Violet flavored, and then an absolute no. And like for some of the no's, you've got like ketchup and things like that. It's just like super gross. But they're fully leaning into it.
Are you saying that the people behind Parma Violet are trying to start a culture war?
Possibly, yeah.
Tell us about the cheese. What have you...
Oh, yeah, let's have a look. You might think we're crackers, but last year we teamed up with the Cheshire Cheese Company to create Parma Violet's cheese, is what it says.
Oh,
I imagine
no.
Someone reading it in that voice.
Yeah, no, yeah. Nailed the delivery.
It looks very pretty, but because it's that colour, I associate it with a dessert, and cheese I don't. Though that being said, you do get fruit in cheese. You know, in a Wensleydale, you might have cranberries and things like that.
Do you have little Parma Violet sweets in the Parma Violet cheese?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I've just looked up the Parma Violet cheese. I instantly hate it
because
it's wrapped in it's like a round wrapped in that wax, like
yes.
Like you get the black, like that black bomber cheddar you get in the UK at the moment.
Yeah.
And it looks like the sort of thing you're meant to like put in your toilet to clean it.
Yes, it does, doesn't it? Medicinal, like you said. It feels very gimmicky, to be honest.
Yeah.
But there'll be someone. That's the thing. There's always someone that's going to like these things.
There's always some fool who'll go for the Parma Violets over the refreshers.
And they do giant ones as well.
No. No. Stop it.
It's the floral flavour that divides the nation, apparently.
I think if you were a kid and someone put Parma violets into your trick-or-treat bag, you would be sorely disappointed.
If you'd never had them before. But what I think the trick is, like, they look so pretty and they look so like, ooh, and just that's obviously, you know, some kid's first true disappointment. You know what I mean? They realize that life really isn't going to quite live up to what they expected when they have their first Parma violet.
When they first learn that adults can lie to them.
Yes. Yeah. Just so bleak.
As a sidebar, Josh, do you want to tell me about the playlist you sent me today, which will be in the notes to this podcast?
Oh yeah, good, because I don't have much else to say about Parma violets. Okay.
Yeah.
So I made a playlist today because I'm a big, you know, as you said in my intro, big horror movie fan, but also a massive fan of pop music. And so I just thought for the listeners, it might be cute to do a fun little bad candy pop confection playlist. So yeah, you can look on Spotify, or I made a YouTube one as well. I like the idea that pop music is so often considered a guilty pleasure, but I don't tend to believe in those at all. I don't believe in guilty pleasures. I think that we should just love what we love and enjoy what we enjoy. So we've got some Mandy Moore on there. Do you remember that song Candy by Mandy Moore?
I remembered it after I played it.
Yeah.
For Ben, for whom some of these artists will go straight over his head. If you can imagine the era around when Britney Spears was a going concern and just after, when everyone sang the word me like it was the month of May.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And most of those songs had like an electronically created track, and a lot of them had that wank, wank, wank sound in the background.
Yeah. That's the vibe,
and it's low cut, boot cut jeans.
Okay, I've got it.
This is the era. So we've got some Mandy Moore, we've got some Britney, we've got some Jessica Simpson, we've got some Craig David, we've got Christina Aguilera. You know, we've got some Prince. You know, you want to, you know, some Marina, some Kylie, some Madonna. So yeah, I sort of go through from the 90s to now all the songs that talk about candy, like some of these
candy,
titles.
Yeah.
Bubblegum Bitch, Marina and the Diamonds. Blow by Beyonce.
Yeah. Strawberry Bubblegum, Justin Timberlake.
That is a good one.
I'm a big fan of the fact that you've put Loverboy by Mariah Carey on there, because we have touched on that inadvertently in a past podcast.
Oh, have you?
When we mentioned Mariah Carey's seminal movie Glitter.
Glitter.
And I was pleased to discover that, because Glitter was released in September 2001, the album, the original soundtrack accompanying it, from which this music comes from, was released on September the 11th, 2001.
And actually, funnily enough, so with Loverboy, the reason that's in here is because it samples the song Candy by Cameo, just like candy. Right. So that's sampled in it. But originally, that sample wasn't going to be used. It was a song by Yellow Magic Orchestra called Firecracker. That's the little hook, and that was going to be the sample that was used. But there's a whole controversy that involves Jennifer Lopez.
Go on.
Which is, I love that we've come from candy to pop music, because I have nothing else to say about Parma Violet.
We know that you really just wanted to talk about Candy by Mandy Moore.
Hard pivot, yeah. So the sample was basically stolen from her, not by J-Lo, but by the head of Sony, Tommy Mottola, who Mariah was married to at the time. And they'd just gone through a rather public, messy divorce. And allegedly he didn't want her career to flourish without him. And so found out what the sample was going to be, used it in a J-Lo song, I'm Real. And so Mariah at the last minute had to change it and use the candy sample instead.
I stole Mariah's sample sounds like such a weird opening to a show. That's so good. I'm so here for that. So if anyone wants to listen to Josh's Bad Candy and Other Tasty Treats playlist, then there are the links to Spotify and YouTube are there. Gotta add Lollipop by Mika to it.
I have, but I wanted to limit the amount of men that are on it.
Okay. To exactly, I think, Prince and Justin Timberlake.
That's it. That's all who's allowed. And even Justin is tenuous. So yeah, and then I was looking at a few sort of movies with candy, and particularly bad candy, because that's we're talking about the worst of the worst. And so have any of you ever seen the movie Jawbreaker?
No,
but please tell me it's like a mad horror movie about an inedible bubblegum.
Well, do we know what a jawbreaker is, first of all?
They're like those very hard, sucky, like big sweets that you're meant to suck rather than bite.
Absolutely.
Into, right?
I think we call them a gobstopper.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So again, we're just seeing the sort of difference. But Jawbreaker is a comedy starring Rose McGowan, written and directed by Darren Stein. And it tells the story of these three teenage girls who accidentally kill their best friend on her birthday after they ball gag her with a jawbreaker. And they're trying to prank her and they lock her in the boot of the car. And they accidentally kill her because she swallows the jawbreaker. And it kills her. And that's the premise for the film.
Do they like try and cover up the crime, or do they go full Weekend at Bernie's and like walk her around?
Hilariously, not the second, but they do. They try and cover it up, but it's very funny. It's very dark. It's kind of like Heathers or Mean Girls. It really fits sort of within that ilk, but it's a little bit low budget. And so it's got some edge to it.
That's a hell of an elevator pitch. You know?
Right?
Yeah.
It's a big reach and they have committed to it.
Do you think it's literally an elevator pitch? They were going into a meeting, they had nothing, and someone was beside them, had brought their kids to work, and they were like licking a gobstop, and they're like, I've got it. Just follow me and watch for the changes.
Follow me and watch for the changes. Or someone was like, oh yeah, God, this thing that happened to me when I was a kid at school. Uh-oh. Based on a true story, true events.
Yeah. Oh my God.
So my second recommendation would be the classic Candyman. Have we seen or heard of Candyman?
So yeah, that's the you say the name five times in the mirror and he'll appear.
Absolutely.
He's a convict who was wrongfully convicted for a crime.
Pretty much,
sort of,
yeah. Played by Tony Todd, and it's very scary. He's got a hook for a hand. They kill his character effectively by smothering him in honey, and he was stung to death by bees. And so they have loads of real bees in the movie that Tony Todd has in his mouth, has all over his body. But they're baby bees, so that they can't sting yet.
Right.
However, Tony Todd went on to do different sequels after. And because he got stung so many times in the first one, because obviously some of them weren't as babyish as they could have been, allegedly he had it written into his contract that for every sting he would get paid an extra $1,000.
I believe the Police had a similar contract early on in their music career.
Oh, very good.
You've got to have an astonishing amount of trust to go, yes, I will let you cover me in bees. The only movie...
Him and Nick Cage.
The only movie that I would let you cover me in bees for is in a real-life recreation of the greatest routines of Eddie Izzard.
Yeah, covered in bees.
Covered in bees.
And then can we remember the book actually originally, but got turned into several screen adaptations in which Turkish Delight plays a key part.
The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Yes, absolutely. Good shout with that little bratty Edmund kid. Scarf in his face with all those Turkish Delights. Have you ever had Turkish Delight?
Yes, it is disgusting.
Yeah, a bit weird.
Oh, I quite like it.
Oh,
well, you're a fucking turncoat then, aren't you, McStay?
Yeah. Yeah, stay away from the Parma Violets, but give me a Turkish Delight any day.
Kind of tracks with you.
To be fair, I've had traditional Turkish Delight, and I've had the Fry's Turkish Delight, which is covered in chocolate, and probably to the disgrace of actual Turkish people, I prefer the chocolate-covered one.
Well, you're not welcome in Istanbul anytime soon.
No.
It is, because I remember my introduction to The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was a cartoon version of it that was on Channel 4, I think.
Yes.
And they've really, in my memory, they really amped up the significance and the tastiness of Turkish Delight. And I longed for it for so long. And so when I tasted it, it was a crushing disappointment.
It's quite a misleading name in some way. Yeah. But it's what sort of name that gets you hooked. Like, it's like American Intelligence or Great Britain. You're like, Turkish Delight. To a child's ear, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm in.
It also feels like one of those, for lack of a better term, olden day sweets. In the same way that, like, it was probably, like, lit back then, but now it's absolutely not. In the same way of, like, you know, oh, we're going to, like, just have a stick and we're going to roll a thing. We're going to hit a stone with a stick. That's a fun game. Like, that hadn't quite... got the equipment for fun, yeah. fun schoolyard games in the same way that they didn't for sweets and chocolate.
Yeah, they're making the bridge between soap and sweets and Turkish Delight as the midpoint.
Very good. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And then I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Oh, my God, yes. With the sequence which my 10-year-old nephew described as when they go into the death tunnel.
100%. Horrible. Chocolate Lake sounds like a good idea, but think about all the shit that goes in there. Like, think about like the River Thames of chocolate.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
That's what they're going to pass off the Britain's waterways as in a few years' time.
That's the colour it will be.
Yeah.
I'm like Augustus Gloop, you know, falling in, getting sucked up that pipe.
They needed safety rails.
They really did. They really did. And some nicer kids.
It is
kids.
Really appetizing. I have to say, the thing that always gets me with Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory is the first room is amazing and then the rest of it is quite bland.
Yeah.
obviously, there's like golden egg laying geese and there's TV and stuff like that. But like that first room is the moneymaker, and then you've got quite a boring tour of an industrial facility for the rest of the day.
It's actually just a factory. Like,
yeah, it's actually just a factory with conveyor belts and packaging and
probably asbestos. You know, like those kids were fucked after. If the chocolate pipe didn't get them, or the bubble gum, then it was going to be the asbestos.
Think what particles were being blown up in the massive fans. Yeah. Think of the avian flu risk with all of those geese. Oh, yeah. Like,
and isn't the movie from the 70s? Like,
yeah, I think 70, 71.
Yeah, like bleak, that. Dirty. That factory wouldn't have been clean. Not up to code. Not up to code at all. So though,
yeah, there should just be a little zoom in on the door of the factory and you see its health and safety rating. You're like, oh, it's a 2.
there have been 0 kids killed in the last 2 days.
Yes.
I love it. It's a 2, but it's in like tiny writing just underneath like the big chocolate fountain and the big, you know, trees with like candy apples on. Like, you can't quite see it because you're just overwhelmed with everything else that's there.
Very nice. Well, so those are my candy viewing.
Yes, absolutely. Those are my movie recommendations for bad candy movies.
Curl up with one of those and your playlist and some Parma Violet.
Absolutely. And it's a perfect Halloween. And then just a random fact. Did you know that apparently a dentist invented cotton candy?
Yes. I love this fact.
Right? I'm going to just read it. It said, you wouldn't expect a dentist to be responsible for helping to pioneer a new type of candy, although maybe he was hoping it would drum up some cavity-related business. But in 1897, a dentist, William Morrison, partnered with confectioner John C. Wharton to devise a machine that used centrifugal force, which sounds very Back to the Future, to turn sugar into cotton-like strands. And the result was cotton candy or candy floss. They didn't name it that until the 20s, and Morrison and Wharton, they called it fairy floss.
The guy who called it cotton candy was another dentist, Joseph Lascaux. Okay. He coined the term cotton candy.
Where did we get candy floss from then?
I don't know where that one came from, but I mean, I guess they were all probably different. Maybe they were different brand names and different companies called it different things to get by. Yeah. Well, they took the machine and the candy, the fairy floss they were calling it, to the World's Fair in St. Louis in 1904. They sold 70,000 boxes of it at that World's Fair alone.
Wow.
Which led to the great molar crisis of St. Louis in 1905, presumably. I love the self-dealing of that.
Yeah.
Dentist.
It's like, that's insidious. I feel like there could be like a Netflix docuseries about that, you know.
Ben, you mentioned the candy desk in the Senate.
I did.
Presidents, US presidents, what do they get?
A candy pinata in the Oval Office at all times.
Oh God, I wish. No, it's presidential M&Ms. Presidential M&Ms have been a thing for nearly 40 years now. They have the presidential seal and the signature of whoever the current president is on them. Nancy Reagan went on a visit to the Soviet Union and gave out M&Ms to Russian kids, and you know they were very popular. And she wanted to ban smoking on Air Force One, and the reason there was lots of smoking on Air Force One is there were lots of cigarette dispensers in Air Force One, because the precursor to presidential M&Ms was presidential cigarettes.
Of course it was.
Under JFK and the like, they would give out US presidential seal branded packets of cigarettes, of 20 cigarettes, to guests.
Incredible.
Yeah, so Ronald Reagan had sort of had a jar of jelly beans instead in his office because he was trying to project this anti-drug image, and then Nancy sort of completed the sweep by getting rid of the last machines on Air Force One. I read about Pop Rocks. They're like the popping candy, rocks of exploding candy in America. In 1979, there was a rumor went around America that a child had exploded when he drank soda and ate Pop Rocks.
Yeah. So linking that to Halloween, there's a movie called Urban Legend, which a serial killer is killing off college students in the style of different urban legends. And they mentioned that like Pop Rocks and soda will explode your intestines.
Wow.
And they do like a fun prank in one of the early scenes where they prove it not to be true. But then I think about Mentos. Have we seen those videos on Instagram where you put
Mentos
like,
and Diet Coke?
Yeah, and everything... Imagine if you drank all of that, would that do the same thing inside your body?
I don't know. Maybe the juice as an acid in your stomach is enough to counteract it.
Or you maybe need so much of the Diet Coke for it to work. Because you know you can't drink that much and have it just stay in one place.
Gargle it.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. So
apparently the rumor about Pop Rocks got so bad that the FDA in America set up a hotline for parents to call.
Oh my god.
To get more information about Pop Rocks. General Foods bought full page ads in newspapers and sent letters to school principals to help assuage worries. And the inventor of Pop Rocks, Bill Mitchell, went on the road explaining Pop Rocks would not cause your kids to explode. And but they had been released in 1975, and early in the 1980s they were pulled from the market briefly before returning. Probably it was as a result of all of this. Bill Mitchell wrote a letter which was published in several local newspapers. And I'm just going to quote a bit of it because it's quite adorable. Dear Mom and Dad, my name is Bill Mitchell. I'm a retired scientist for the General Foods Corporation of White Plains, New York. I am also an inventor. I have the distinction, if you want to call it that, of inventing the new Pop Rocks crackling candy that is creating such a sensation across the country. I've brought a lot of fun into the world with Pop Rocks, I guess, but I'm writing this letter because I want to assure you that the product is a safe one. Safety is one of my real concerns. I have 7 children of my own and 14 grandchildren. You've probably heard a lot of wild rumors about Pop Rocks. I can assure you that we have investigated, and there is nothing to worry about. You know, you hear a lot of people talk about how serious business is, that people who work for big corporations don't have very much fun. Well, Pop Rocks is a proof that this isn't so. This is a fun product, and a lot of people have enjoyed the product. The company has sold more than 500 million packages. Can you believe that? Anyway, I just wanted to say to you that this product is a safe and fun product. If you'd like to write to me, drop me a line to Bill Mitchell, Pop Rocks inventor, General Foods Corporation, White Plains, New York. Isn't that adorable? I love the fact that he sounds like thrilled by his success, baffled by the reaction, and completely open to criticism in a way that we just don't see anymore nowadays.
But 7 kids. What a dog. Yeah. What a dirty dog.
His rock definitely pops.
It absolutely does.
Then I read about some candy names. Pez. Why is Pez called Pez?
Oh, I looked this up. Is it peppermint? Is that
the
means?
Yeah, the German word for peppermint is Pfefferminz.
Cute. I'm sure that was an option for a name for Gwyneth Paltrow's first child as well, but they went with Apple.
You're probably right. Yeah, they went with Apple. Lollipop was coined in 1931. There's a few different suggestions of why things are called lollipop, one of them being that lolly is your tongue, and pop mean popping it out, so you might be popping your tongue out to eat them. But it was certainly coined in 1931. Named after a racehorse at the time, which was called Lolly with a Y and then a separate word, Pop. And the man who coined the term was called George Smith. He marketed the modern lollipop through his company, Bradley Smith. But the guy who invented the machine, which sticks the sticks into the candy to make the lollipops in the first place, is a guy called Samuel Bourne. He was an immigrant to America, and he was awarded the key to the city of San Francisco as a result of inventing the machine.
Oh, wow.
And another very famous bar is named after a horse as well. Do you know this one?
No.
It's Snickers.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Snickers is named after a horse, one of the favourite horses of the Mars family, who lived on their farm, which was called Milky Way Farm. They'd already made their money by marketing the Milky Way.
All the pieces are coming together. They're all coming together, Barry.
And I like that. And I did mention they were marketed under the term marathon in the UK from the 60s until 1990. And then they decided they would just call it Snickers mm-hmm. worldwide. But then Mars, confusingly, had also marketed a bar in America called a Marathon, which was not like the Marathon in the UK, because in America they called it Snickers. The Marathon in the USA was more like the UK's Curly Whirly. Oh. Confusing. I also like Milk Duds. They're quite an American candy.
Yes, they are.
They're little chocolate-covered caramel mm-hmm. things. And the name suggests why they're called that. They were accidents. Hoffman and Company of Chicago were trying to manufacture a perfectly spherical chocolate-covered caramel sweet, and they could not do it.
Oh,
and they
no.
kept referring to the batches that had failed as duds, and then they just gave up and called them Milk Duds.
They are a little bit bland, I will say. I have had some.
A lot of these, particularly the American candies, have been around for a long old time.
Have you ever had Peeps?
What are Peeps? No.
So Peeps I had for the first time when I was in America. They were like, oh, it's Halloween, you have to have these. And they do different types, but they're sort of like, they're branded marshmallows, but they are like so sickeningly sweet. I think they're like coated in sugar as well. But they do little different types that look like pumpkins or monsters or skulls, little marshmallows that you can get. But you know when something is so sugar coated that it's like gritty and you feel like the moment you bite into it, you've dissolved half your tooth away. They're like that. So they weren't my favorite, I must say.
Oh, okay. Marshmallow already made entirely of sugar with sugar added to it is, funny you mentioned them. Do you know what the marshmallows you get in Lucky Charms are? Do you know what they're called? They're sort of banana flavored.
Leprechaun's gonads?
The marshmallows in Lucky Charms are inspired by a bag of sweets you could get, which are called circus peanuts, but they're not peanuts.
Oh.
They're little marshmallows.
And anything to do with the circus?
I think presumably you would buy these when you were going to circus, little like hardened marshmallow things. But it made me think of, is it Bombay duck? Is not a duck at all, it's a fish, a dish. Yeah, so another one of those confusingly named things. As is an old-fashioned peanut butter and molasses flavored type candy called Mary Jane.
Oh.
Yeah, originally made in 1914 by Lord's Candy Company. Robert O'Lord had named it after his favourite aunt. I love that his name was Robert O'Lord. Robert O'Lord, why have you called our sweet after a drug? And Kit Kats. Food called Kit Kat goes back to the 18th century. There were meetings of the political Kit Kat Club, spelt with a K for Kit C for Kat, in London, and they would be served mutton pies served by a pastry chef called Christopher Cat, and so they named them for him. And finally, another one for America, saltwater taffy. That's quite like for people over here, that feels like something we hear mentioned
all the time.
No idea what it is.
No clue.
You've definitely had something that is essentially taffy.
Okay.
Chewits and Starburst are basically what taffy is. It's sugar and salt and flavouring and corn syrup, and then it's pulled and moulded to aerate it so it becomes soft and chewy. So my brain assumed it was a toffee thing because it sounds like toffee.
Yeah.
It's that sort of moulded.
When you say
thing.
Pulled and aerated, is that what those weird sort of machines are, like massaging the...
Yes. What looks like some candy flesh.
Yes.
In a rope, yeah. So it got its name because a candy maker, David Bradley, sold some taffy. And in the 1880s, he lived on the east coast of America. There was some storms in the Atlantic Ocean. And salt water flooded his taffy stock. And people still came in the next day. The flooding wasn't so bad that people didn't want to come to get their taffy. So he jokingly referred to it as saltwater taffy. And the name stuck, even though salt water, indeed high degrees of salt, aren't really an ingredient in this at all. And in 1923, John Edmiston tried to trademark the name saltwater taffy to stop anyone else making money from the term. And the Supreme Court decided that the name had been in use basically for 40 years and people around the country had picked up the term. So he wasn't able to receive any royalties at all. And people now refer to it as nearly any taffy, whether it's salty or not, a saltwater taffy in America.
It's when they ask for a soda water and they want a club soda.
Yes.
What's the club? What's that for? You can have a soda water, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's fine. The version of Club Tropicana that's for heterosexual people.
Yeah. Boring and transparent.
Yeah.
But none of those confusing names are my worst candy. Instead, I've gone for another traditional American candy bar, the Baby Ruth.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Now, Josh, you spent quite a lot of time in America. Have you had a Baby Ruth?
I've not actually. I know of them, but I've not had one.
Who do you think it's named after?
Now, is this a red herring or is it the baseball guy?
Yes, it is a complete red herring. You might imagine it is named after Babe Ruth, the baseball player.
Baby Jane. Maybe it's the baby.
It's both. It's a Baby Ruth. The Curtis Candy Company claimed, when they released it in 1921, that they had named their candy bar after the daughter of the American president, Grover Cleveland, Ruth, who had died quite young. This was released in 1921. Ruth had died 17 years previously.
Oh.
24 years previously, Cleveland had left the White House. Coincidentally, in 1921, the famous baseball player Babe Ruth's career was just beginning to take off. But Babe Ruth had a tie-in with another company to manufacture a Babe Ruth-approved chocolate bar.
Oh.
So the Curtis Candy Company had not negotiated an endorsement deal with Ruth. And basically, this seems like they had gone, well, he's the most famous person in America, basically, at the moment. Let's make a chocolate bar that piggybacks on his success without having to go through the rigmarole of convincing him to endorse our product. It seems like they came up with this idea of naming it after Baby Ruth Cleveland.
What a spin.
Well, also, I think, you know, can you imagine the meetings where they go, listen, we're going to have to market this. It can either be famous baseball player or dead presidential baby.
Those are the only two options.
Yeah.
That meeting got adjourned pretty quickly.
Who do we have to pay? Okay, yeah. We'll do the other one.
So there's a book called Imponderables by David Feldman, and he writes, the trademark was patterned exactly after the engraved lettering of the name used on a medallion struck for the Chicago World's Columbian Exposition in 1893, picturing the president, his wife, and daughter Baby Ruth. So the actual writing on the chocolate bar looks like the writing on this medal to celebrate Baby Ruth's birth. Suggestion is, again, that they thought they'd use that as cover for what they were up to. And in another book, Tom Burnham, he suggests that the candy bar was named after the granddaughter of Mr. and Mrs. George Williamson, who'd sold the original formula to the Curtis Company. That seems unlikely. Even Snopes, the famous debunking website, have weighed in on this. They've denied the idea that it was the granddaughter of the Williamsons, saying that the Baby Ruth bar came about when Otto Schnering, the founder of the Curtis Candy Company, made some alterations to his company's first candy offering, a confection known as Candy Cake, and rebranded it. It looks a bit like a Snickers bar or a Lion
right.
bar.
What's it taste like?
Bite into it. Chocolate and peanuts and caramel. Yeah. Yeah. But the Baby Ruth bar took off in quite a big way, in more ways than one, as you'll come to learn. In 1929, the Curtis Candy Company sponsored the Baby Ruth Hour, a CBS radio program. And for a company that protested that they hadn't named their chocolate bar after Babe Ruth, in 1932, Babe Ruth famously called a shot. This is a lot of American sports fans will be aware of this. That the story goes that he pointed out over the bleachers and then smashed a ball over the bleachers for a home run, and it was to help his team win the World Series in 1932. And in the aftermath of that match was played at Wrigley Field in Chicago. The Curtis Company installed an illuminated advertising sign for the Baby Ruth chocolate bar on the roof of a flat across the road, in line with where that shot had been hit. And it stood for four decades.
Oh,
shots at Wrigley Field until the 70s had this sign in the background. And again, this company had denied it was anything to do with Babe Ruth. In 1985, Nabisco had bought the bar by then. They paid $100,000 for product placement for Baby Ruth to appear in The Goonies. In 1995, a company representing Babe Ruth's estate licensed his name and likeness for a Baby Ruth marketing campaign. In 2007, in an edition of the Chicago Cubs game program, there's a full-page ad for Baby Ruth's with the slogan, the official candy bar of Major League Baseball and proud sponsor of the Chicago Cubs. And the same season, they had a TV ad for Baby Ruth's where they had an entire stadium filled with people who were eating Baby Ruth's. So instead of being able to sing, they were humming Take Me Out to the Ball Game. But definitely they did not name this bar after Babe Ruth.
Oh no, absolutely. Just a coincidence. All coincidences.
And if you think that's bad enough, if you think naming a bar in a mercenary way is a meagre excuse for it being the worst candy on earth, I offer you this addendum. Otto Schnering chartered a plane in 1923 to drop thousands of Baby Ruth chocolate bars over the city of Pittsburgh to help promote the chocolate bar. Now, he was clever enough to give each chocolate bar its own parachute. So there wasn't what you'd imagine, maybe hundreds of kids having their eyes taken out and by airdropped chocolate death bars.
Yeah.
In fact, the Pittsburgh stunt was such a success that over the next 6 years, Schnering had parachute drops of Baby Ruth chocolate bars performed over cities across the USA in 40 different states. As I say, for 6 years, until the Depression kicked in and throwing away chocolate bars was probably deemed a bit unseemly. One of these candy drops took place in Florida in 1927. Now, attending this was a young kid called Paul Tibbetts. Paul Tibbetts had moved with his family, his dad, Paul Warfield Tibbetts Sr., and his wife, Enola Gay Tibbetts. When he was 8, they moved to Florida to escape the Midwestern winters of Illinois. And he was very interested in flying, and his mother agreed to pay $1 to get him into an airplane at a local carnival. And in 1927, that airplane happened to be the one that was going to be flown by a barnstormer, an aviation sort of trick performer called Doug Davis. And his job that day was to drop Baby Ruth candy bars with tiny parachutes to the crowd attending the horse races at Hiley Park Racetrack in Florida. 12-year-old Paul was so taken by this that he took up a career in aviation. He became so experienced that he actually rose to the rank of Air Force Colonel in the United States Air Force. And you might remember that I said his mother's name was Enola Gay. And Paul, when he was given control of a B-29 Super Fortress, he named it in honor of his mother. The Enola Gay had her name printed on the nose cone. And a couple of days later, in August 1945, Paul Tibbetts, inspired by his flight on a Baby Ruth plane, was the man in command of the fighter plane that dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima in Japan in 1945. So I put it to you that the Baby Ruth chocolate bar gave us the death of 60,000 Japanese people. So our candy dates this week for the world's worst candy are Ben's suggestion of United States military chocolate, military grade in more ways than one. Josh's suggestion of Parma Violets, the
one he doesn't like.
I was going to say the grandma's favourite at every kid's birthday party, and my suggestion of the genocidal Baby Ruth chocolate bar.
Well, this seems like an easy win for Parma Violets, doesn't it?
I'm so sorry, but when I read that this chocolate bar was not only fakely named after a baseball player, but the guy who dropped the atomic bomb was inspired by a flight on a plane that was dropping these chocolate bars. I was pretty certain you would have to really work hard to convince me it wasn't the worst candy on earth. And I'm going with myself this week. I'm sorry. It's got to be.
No, that's fair. That was just like a good horror movie, actually, wasn't it? That was a story where it slowly crept up on you.
Yeah.
And by the end, I knew what was going to happen and I was helpless to stop it.
Yeah. It's just a twist that a lot of people won't see coming. It's just great. Before we go, I've got to give you some of the best news of the week. And this good news comes to us from the BBC Sports website and from our old friends, the Footballers of San Marino, absolutely legendary team who've appeared on this podcast many a time, and one of the worst teams in international football. They have not won in 132 games and are currently 207th and last in the FIFA World Rankings. They lost 2-0 to Northern Ireland, but that match saw a 41-year-old called Roberto Di Maio make his debut for his international team. What a lovely thing. I think he's actually turned 41 since it happened. Yeah. What a lovely thing for someone in who presumably is by day some sort of ordinary, what's his job?
A postman.
People, so many of the San Marino team, they're car salesmen, there's accountants, painter decorators, all of that stuff. Di Maio actually works for the country's football federation as an academy coach as well. He's really just living his best life.
He really is.
For his international team.
That also means that I've still got 11 months before Gareth Southgate has to let me down gently.
Yeah, so he made his debut in March and he's played all six of the games for San Marino.
I mean, I think we've mentioned this before, but I'm pretty sure appearing for the San Marino national team is basically like jury service.
Yeah. Everyone gets a go at some point or another. Josh, where can people find you online? What can they find you doing there? And where can they watch Latent Image and things like that?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, the new one, Letterboxd, all under my name at Joshua Tonks. And you can find my debut feature horror, The Latent Image, on Amazon Prime, where you can rent it. You can pre-order the DVD. And if anyone's around in central London on the 22nd of October, we're having a limited theatrical release, which is one screening at the Prince Charles Cinema, 6:15 p.m. on Sunday, October the 22nd. We're doing a Q&A with my friend Mike, who does the Evolution of Horror podcast, and Alex, the director. So come along, and we'll see you there, hopefully.
Very, very cool. Meanwhile, we're all off to hire a Zeppelin, drop some Parma Violets on the local school, and wait 20 years to see what happens. Thank you all for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.